This program is sponsored by Wicked Chronic in Natick, Massachusetts. Located at 185 Worcester Street, right on Route 9, they can be reached at 508-545-8105 or at wickedchronicvendorcommerce.com. Wicked Chronic is a boutique-style retail shop that focuses on selling counterculture products such as Wiccan cannabis cultures coming together in a unique setting. You need something for that special spell? Go on down to Wicked Chronic in Natick, Massachusetts and speak to Beverly. Tell them Dr. Chris sent you. Check them out today. Welcome to the Dead TV Podcast, a podcast dedicated to all the canceled television shows in the horror, science fiction, and fantasy genre. I am your host, Dr. Chris.
And I'm Mr. Seneca.
And we are continuing our coverage of the 1980s television series, Friday the 13th, the series, also known as Friday's Curse for anybody living in Canada or the United Kingdom, where it's apparently called. Mr. Seneca has the episode synopsis for us for our first episode of the evening.
All right, tonight's episode, the first one of the night, is episode number 9, season 1, Root of All Evil. Ryan and Mickey search for a cursed mulcher, which is the murder weapon of choice for a gardener's assistant. Originally aired on November 28th, 1987.
Now, one thing I wanted to point out that I didn't mention last time that we were doing the previous two episodes is that a name comes up a lot on these Friday the 13th episodes, or at least a few times, named David Winter, and he has actually been on the on Radio Horror. In fact, he was one of the first guests I had on the show many, many, many years ago. Timothy Bond wrote the episode that we're the previous episode we did, Shadow Boxer, and the episode of this one is Alan King.
I really like this episode.
Yes, after the last two, this was a really good episode.
Oh yes, the two that we're doing on this episode. Far and wide, just above, head and shoulders beyond Dr. Jack and Shadow Boxer. Yeah, this was quite a relief for us to watch it.
Yeah, that was just insufferable to sit through the last two times.
It was a little tough, but The Root of All Evil, basically, it's all about this cursed mulcher, you know, this portable mulcher, wood chipper type of thing. And right in the very beginning, we see a gardener basically kill an old lady with a rake and shove her in the mulcher. No blood, no gore, nothing. Apparently, this cursed object sucks in all of that blood and gore so to leave it sparkling clean. And right there at the very beginning, we get that first killing.
Which
nice,
is fun.
Very formulaic.
Yeah, she was a very annoying old woman, and it kind of reminded me of a lot of people's reaction to Angela Lansbury this past week. I don't think anybody wanted to shove Angela Lansbury into a mulcher, but Jesus Christ, the hate against Angela Lansbury was unbelievable. And if you want to know what we're talking about, just Google Angela Lansbury. It'll probably be one of the first news articles that pop right up. But that immediately came to mind because it happened the exact day as her outspoken statement about sexual harassment in Hollywood.
Yeah. Mickey actually makes a notation that it's been 2 months when she's talking to her fiance Lloyd on the phone. It's been 2 months that she's been here at Curious Goods and, you know, have been searching for cursed objects. So 2 months have elapsed, and we get from the Halloween episode to what appears to be springtime in this episode. Very curious seasonalities they have there.
Yeah, I still wonder, as we're recording this, it's December 3rd, 2017, if we're going to have a Christmas episode coming up in the middle of all this?
Are we? Are we going to be recording on Christmas?
No. Are we going to have a Christmas episode of Friday the 13th?
I don't think so. I don't see it on the roster here.
Yeah, I think we pointed this out in a previous episode. Barclay Hope plays Lloyd, Roby's fiance on the show. And he was in PSI Factor, which was a very popular Canadian series that ran from 1996 to 2000. Final Destination 5, Paycheck, and currently plays Cliff Blossom on Riverdale.
Oh.
Or he did.
Yeah.
Or he does. He does, sorry. Cliff
well,
Blossom.
He was originally only contracted for the first episode, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then they just brought him back to kind of tie up this whole Mickey's fiancé storyline, which I think works a lot, works very well in this episode. You get a closure on that terrible relationship that she's in, you know, kind of loveless. You know, they never say I love you at all during the entire episode.
Now,
and he's just kind of a douchey guy.
Now, I think that of the three main characters, the fourth character of the show goes hand in hand with the shop itself. It's the Manifest. The
yes.
Manifest is in every single episode. It has to be, because they have to figure out who the hell Uncle Lewis or the two idiot cousins sold all the cursed objects to before they realized, uh-oh, they're all cursed objects, we got to get them all back.
Yep.
And then the shop itself. So they kind of like the shop itself and the Curious Goods and the Manifest go hand in hand as being like a fourth character for the show.
I mean, I suppose so, because they do have a lot of personality. It has the handwritten accounts of every object. And even when they think that they don't have anything or hadn't sold something, you know, it pops up in the Manifest just under a different title. Like, in the next episode, that it says magazine when it's actually supposed to be a comic book, you know.
Also notice that none of the items actually stick with the original owners?
No. Well, I mean, they're cursed. So I would assume that once the devil has taken his fair share of killings, it seeks out a new owner. And in this episode particularly, I think it's the first one that we see where the object itself kind of has this draw on the evilness within the gardener's assistant a little later, where, you know, he's like looking at the mulcher and his eyes go kind of glassy, and it's almost as if he would in that instant go, yes, master, I'll kill. Yeah.
Kill for me and you'll get money. We're going to spoil this right now. You throw people in the mulcher, it produces money? What?
Yeah.
That seems a little strange. It's like, well, then why was it a cursed printing press? And by the way, in Elise's book, Elise Wax, our once a month extra co-host for the show, it mentions that there's no place to put that mulcher in that antique store.
No, not at all. That would have been a sidewalk sale.
And, yeah, I was going to say, Mr. Seneca, if you need a mulcher, do you go to Home Depot or Lowe's, or do you go to an antique store?
I would certainly go to Home Depot, you know, rent something like that.
Yeah, this isn't like one of those things that, oh, the older models, that's what you want to buy. Don't buy any of the 2017 models because they're not built correctly. No, you go to a Lowe's and buy a 2017, or in this case, 1987, mulcher, because it's going to be top of the line. Everything's going to be brand new and pristine and in working order with a better warranty than something from 40 years ago. How old did they say the mulcher is?
From 1937.
Yeah, would you ever use a mulcher from 1937?
I mean, I would be worried about it breaking down.
Oh, the parts alone must be ridiculous.
I mean, I was looking in my research on wood mulchers and wood chippers. I was looking to try to find what model that they used for the show. Unfortunately, I was never able to find the exact model that they used. Maybe it was kind of a Frankenstein type of device. But I did find a gas-powered wood chipper called the Eager Beaver. And it's kind of an antique-ish wood chipper, about the same size as the one that they use in the show, a little bit more bulk to it. The wheels and the frame definitely have almost like a car-type engine on it, which would power the device. You need a lot of power to actually, you know, break down branches and wood. So what they show in the episode is more like, you know, a very large square box with a tube on the top. Which I suppose you could fit a motor inside that big rectangular back end of it, but it would be way too heavy for a golf cart to actually pull.
By the
So,
way,
definitely a prop.
the actor who plays what's his name? Rico. The bum, which by the way, okay, so this woman, this widower, she owns this vast thing of land. She has all these gardeners around here, and she's letting these homeless people just like live on her land because you got that guy with the bottle who's after our main antagonist for money.
Yeah, the gardener's assistant, Adrian.
Correct. Adrian, by the way, is a very prolific actor today, having been on Veronica
Oh.
Mars, Just Shoot Me, Galaxy Quest, AI.
Great actor.
Yeah, huge actor. You don't recognize him with hair. Shave his head, then you'll recognize him. Because
Oh my God. You know, I was astounded that of the recognized a rec I can't say the word. that I could recognize this actor.
Yeah, and when I say Galaxy Quest, he was Mathazar, the leader of the aliens that hired
Oh.
Tim Allen and his co-stars from the TV
Yes.
series to go fight the giant reptile alien. I forgot the bad guy's
He's the
name,
green
but
guy.
yeah. But Mathazar was the leader. He was like, "You will save us."
Oh, the ship was this big. Trying to laugh. Oh my God, great actor.
That is
Great
such a
actor.
great part in that movie. And he was on Powers, and he was in American Gothic. He was in Carmilla. I didn't know there was a Carmilla TV series until just now. He was on the miniseries Bad Blood. And he was, by the way, the voice of Felix Faust in Justice League Dark, which I think we
Oh.
talked about in our coverage of Justice League Dark, the last episode of the Constantine series.
Yes,
I
yes.
believe now that I'm seeing his picture, I'm like, wait a minute, I think we just talked about this guy, but not for Friday the 13th. And that's where
Yeah.
it comes up. So,
Small world.
small world. I also like to just point out that Alan King, who directed this episode, directed many episodes of Kung Fu, The Legend Continues. Alfred Hitchcock Presents, he directed 14 episodes of that, but unfortunately passed away in 2009. So he joins,
Oh.
Chris Wiggins, aka Jack, up in the big antique store in the sky.
Yeah. You know, may he rest in peace. He was also one of those great actors. So, Adrian, you
Alan
know,
King. Were you talking about Alan King or Chris Wiggins?
Chris Wiggins.
Chris Wiggins. Okay, yeah, Alan King was the director of the episode. Okay,
Yeah.
so Adrian, go on.
So, Adrian, from his conversation with the bum, it's come you come to realize that he owes a lot of money to some sort of debt collector that's going to send out guys and crush his legs. So he is very desperate for money. The bum knows where he is, and he's going to tell the debt collectors, and in order to shut him up, he's basically asking like $500 a week, which like is kind of ridiculous at that point to ask, you know, because he's a gardener's assistant. He doesn't make that much money. But he, for some reason, gets the idea to, you know, knock him out and feed him to the wood chipper. And then he gets some money. Probably not a lot of money, just some bills kind of roll out, which begs me to ask the question, is it the net worth of the person that actually comes out the other side, or the worth of the soul?
Yeah, 'cause when Smitty dies, who I was kind of shocked that they killed him off. I mean, nobody is safe on this show, but for our rotten hero, rotten bad guy to do that, it was like, God, this guy was so nice to you, and you did that to him.
Yeah, and he actually did not get tempted. He was the owner of the mulcher, but he did not get tempted to use it. So I'm thinking that the temptation comes only because you have evil in your heart. Because this guy Smitty, he was just an overall just a welcoming, warm character. He was beloved by his employees and his employer, but not at all just any idea that this was a cursed object. When Ryan and Mickey offer him $2,500 for the mulcher, he's like, "Oh yeah, let me get it right now," you know. And then, of course, Adrian kills him in that moment. So, you know, one of the things that also kind of strikes me is when they talk to the original owner, the person that the mulcher was sold to, and he starts talking about, you know, to Jack, about people being like stocks, like, you know, diversify your portfolio. You know, doctors and lawyers yield more. So again, like, is it the quality of the soul or is it the net worth of the individual? I don't know. They never really make that clear.
No, they don't. But, you know, sometimes there's a lot of plot holes with these devices that they create for the show itself. The guy who originally owned the mulcher in the very beginning of the episode goes to the nut house,
insane asylum.
So he is basically nobody obviously believes this whole story about the you know what happened. So you know, in any modern capacity, he would definitely be locked up. One thing I also want to point out is that Roby has the biggest hair of any woman I've ever seen in the 1980s in one particular scene.
I noticed that too. I know she already has kind of semi-curly wavy hair, but it is frizzed out to her shoulders.
It's ridiculous in this episode. What type of guitar is Ryan playing with, by the way?
Oh, I didn't catch that one. I know it's
a 67 Stratocaster.
Stratocaster, that's it.
And then, of course, Lloyd is jealous of Ryan, which he should be, because Ryan's looking at his cousin every 5 minutes going, I want to tap that. But she points out they're only something that really disturbs Elise. Roby points out, Mickey, that they're only cousins by marriage, but Lloyd sneaks into Mickey's, tries to sneak in, and he climbs up the fire escape. But then he goes back into her bedroom, and does he leave by the fire escape too?
I think so.
What the hell? Just leave through the front door.
And Mickey has a full right to be scared of someone popping into her bedroom windows or bedroom porch door. Because in the last episode on Shadow Dancer, she was attacked that way. So, of course, she's going to be very hesitant of, you know, anyone trying to come into her windows. Like, that's instant. Like, you were just attacked in your bed. So, yeah, you know, your fiancé should not be... Yeah, of course he didn't know about the incident, but, you know, he should not be climbing in through the bedroom window.
By the way, I think Smitty's first name was Robert.
Yeah, and his name is Robert Smith.
Yes,
so they call him Smitty.
Yes, you know, I was thinking of Robert Smith of The Cure.
No relation.
They want to buy the mulcher back, and Ryan says they'll buy it for like two. This is, by the way, before Smitty dies. That they'll buy it for like $2,000 or $2,500.
$2,500.
And Roby says, "Where are we going to get that kind of money?" And it's like, I'm assuming that Uncle Lewis was loaded, and they were left more than just a outstanding debt in that store.
I would assume so, but you really don't know. It's not mentioned that they were wealthy. You know, they never really fixed up Curious Goods. It just still kind of looks exactly as they received it.
Mm.
I think most of the money of the estate was the actual property itself plus the objects inside. But anyway, you know, the fiancé actually finds, you know, goes into the vault because Mick is trying to convince him that, yes, these objects are cursed. And that doll, that damn doll, actually, you know, has this menacing look on its face. And she says, like, oh, put that back. And, you know, because, you know, he says, oh, what's this doll going to do, slash my throat? Yeah.
Also, they mention, I have it in my notes. Hold on a second. She mentions other cases that they... Okay, here we go. Crushed people... Sorry. This thing made people go blind. When did that happen, by the way? Homes burning down. When did that happen? And the killer doll we know was from the first episode. But the other cases she mentioned, we've never seen. We're only on episode 9.
That's true.
So they're picking up cursed objects between episodes that either we didn't have scripts for, or a writer thought it'd be funny to throw it in there just as they, like, let you know that, you know, time is passing on the show a little bit more frequently, and they're doing other things between the episodes that we're not privy to. Which, by the way, would open this show up to an amazing series of novels or comic books if someone were ever to resurrect Friday's Curse as one of those two today, in 2017.
That's quite possible.
Because there are no Friday Curse novels out there. And you could write Friday Curse novels now if you could get the copyright to fill in the blanks on maybe some of these, or have them happen in between the episodes. Because this isn't like television today, like Gotham or Arrow or Supernatural, where it's like an overarching plot line every single season and every episode has to be connected in some way, or they have to make a reference to, you know, a character who's not in that episode today, you know, right now, but he's going to, you know, he's going to come back in an episode or two. This was a very standalone show. And again, I think I mentioned this before, it wasn't until the X-Files came along that we had a show where you had to watch every single episode. Friday the 13th is a drop-in show.
Yeah, you know, all the episodes were very formulaic, and they didn't have much of a relation to each other beyond a plot line or two, maybe, with the main characters.
Correct. Watch Inheritance, just to understand who all the characters are, and then watch any episode you think that, oh, this episode about a comic book would be good, or, oh, this episode about a killer record player would be good.
Yep. Yep.
I mean, if I was recommending this episode to Mr. Zeneca for the first time, it might be jumping ahead a little bit too far, because season three we're introduced to the other new main character of the show, but there's a heavy BDSM episode coming up in season three.
I love it.
Yes.
Well, you know, as we're talking about woodchippers, did you know that between 1992 and 2002, 31 people actually died in woodchippers?
By going into one?
Well, they were killed by woodchippers. It doesn't say exactly how, but this is a report from the American Medical Association.
Okay.
So 31 people actually died of a woodchipper. But there is a very famous murder that took place in Connecticut that seems to be the basis for the movie Fargo, the 1996 movie Fargo, where a man ends up killing his wife and disposing of her body through a wood chipper, and it was one of the cases that kind of turned forensic science on its head, because when he returned the wood chipper, it was completely clean. Lots of bleach, everything else. And those types of devices, if you were to return it to Home Depot, you would return it with splinters, and, you know, you don't really clean those things. So that was, like, suspect number one. And then they had found a chainsaw also, in which he had cut portions of her body, and really they never found the complete body at all. You know, so Hella Crafts, so she was actually killed by her husband, who was kind of a pilot, and it's a very, very famous case. There's also a mass murderer or serial killer that used wood chippers to cut up 49 women, although not sure how many of those 49 were actually used in the wood chipper, but he cut up 49 women using, you know, for a portion of it, the wood chipper, in order to feed them to his pigs. And when he was caught, he was hoping to actually do one more so that he would make it an even 50 bodies that he would have fed to the pigs. And so that serial killer's name is Picton.
And there's two references in great horrorpedia, one a little bit more obscure than the other one, about how someone died in a wood chipper. Have you ever seen the movie Tucker and Dale versus Evil?
No. What's that one about?
Oh my God, are you serious? Tucker and Dale versus Evil is about two hillbillies who go up to the mountains after they bought a cabin and want to spend their summer vacation, like, relaxing, shooting and like being good old Southern boys up there. And a bunch of teenagers show up, and the reverse of what most horror movie tropes happens. The teenagers are the serial killers who get, like, I think they get It's been a few years since I've seen the movie, so I'm just, my memory is just a
Sure.
little bit not so sharp on this one. Alan Tudyk, by the way, of Firefly fame, plays one of the two hillbillies, and the teenagers are the ones who end up becoming the serial killers due to getting intoxicated or something happens to them, and it's the hillbillies who are the victims this time.
Ooh,
And
I like the twist to that.
yes, and one of the teenagers dives at them. They duck, and he goes right into the wood chipper, spraying another girl right in the face, like full Bukkake style of blood. On an
I mean,
episode on the fourth.
honestly, that's what would happen if you were put into a wood chipper. Like, we're just bags of gore, so yeah,
Yeah.
it would squirt out the other side.
On an episode of Supernatural in the sixth season, the fourth episode of season six, called Weekend at Bobby's, a demon or a vampire goes right into the wood chipper when Bobby ducks and is sprayed out all over his next door neighbor who was constantly trying to hit on Bobby.
Oh.
Yeah. And then, sorry, one more. In Friday the 13th, going back to Friday the 13th now,
yep.
The remake movie, which also stars, by the way, one of the actors from Supernatural, Jason is Jason Voorhees has a chain wrapped around his neck, and the guy Clay drives the chain into a wood chipper, strangling Jason to death.
Interesting.
Yes.
I like it.
So that is also a great use of a wood chipper in a Friday the 13th setting. Jared Padalecki plays Clay, and again, that's, I thought that was kind of interesting because that immediately reminded me of that when I saw the episode. I was like, oh wait, Jason wood chipper, and like the top of his head is like banged into it. I think, you know, it's supposed to imply that Jason dies by like the strangulation of the chain being fed into the wood chipper. So,
yeah,
breaking
yeah.
his neck. But, of course, at the end of the movie, he pops up out of the water.
As he does.
But none of the villains on this show, I think, return, other than Uncle Lewis. So, but we're only in
the
episode
doll returns
9.
In another episode.
What does?
The doll.
The doll does appear
doll.
In one more episode. But none of the objects escape from the containment unit, I believe. Unless someone breaks in. But, again, we're only in episode 9, so I don't want to go too far ahead.
Yeah.
Jack and Ryan get jobs helping out to keep an eye on things.
They're trying to track down the mulcher and find out what's happening to Smitty. They get jobs. They find out that Adrian actually has control of the wood chipper. And chase ensues. Ryan hits his head on the monument. And Lloyd and Mickey
Bang.
End up interrupting Adrian, threatening the rich old lady, and his imminently going to kill her to put her in the mulcher.
Yes, and out of the three main characters, that as far as we can tell on screen, Mickey is the first one to get laid.
They did have that scene, yes.
They do have the scene where she is putting her robe back on after Lloyd's little visit again. I just had to point that out. Out of everyone who's gotten any on this show, it's only Mickey.
Yeah, we don't have yum moments of this show, but, you know, yeah, that's in there.
Yeah, no, go girl, you got some from your fiancé, and then he breaks up with you.
Yeah, because she won't leave the store.
No,
she
has
this responsibility.
Yes, you have duty before booty.
I like that. I like that.
That's a superhero mantra because of all the superheroes, which Mickey and Ryan are not really superheroes, but they do have a duty to the store, and they must put the duty before love.
Yeah. And so the body count in this episode, I counted 5.
Yes, I did too. I got 5 dead people for Root of Evil. We're going to take a quick break between this and the next episode. We have some spots from some great shows that we have linked up to on a podcast support group page on Facebook. And we'd like to thank them by playing their promos now here on the Radio of Horror Network. And we'll be back shortly.
Hi, I'm Ellie, and this is Rob.
Howdy.
And we're the hosts of Horror Never Sleeps, a new weekly horror movie retrospective podcast. We will be reviewing your favourite scary movies like Nightmare on Elm Street, Halloween, and Psycho.
Also, we'll be covering classic gems like Maniac Cop, The Lost Boys,
The Human Centipede.
Whoa. No.
Oh, we'll see. First episode will be released mid-November. You can listen on iTunes or your favourite podcast app.
Until then, stay scared. Ooh.
Yeah, we won't be doing that.
Hi, I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca.
We're the hosts of a new true crime podcast called Yours in Murder.
We put out a new episode every week. We switch between covering true crime cases together and analyzing true crimes in our minisodes.
We take turns on the minisodes, focusing on our unique perspectives.
I have a degree in forensic science.
And I have one in journalism.
So we're able to go beyond Wikipedia and dive into the facts of the case. We look at the forensic evidence and the spin put on cases by the media.
Check us out on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and like us on Facebook for an update on today in true crime history.
As always, we are Yours in Murder.
And we're back here with Tales of the Undead, and Mr. Zeneca has the episode synopsis for us.
All right, it's episode 10 of season 1, Tales of the Undead. Ryan believes that a half-man, half-monster comic book hero has come to life and is responsible for the murder of a shopkeeper. Originally aired on January 25th, 1988.
Now, this episode is near and true to my heart. Out of the two of us, Mr. Zeneca is a casual comic book fan. I am a hardcore comic book reader. I buy comic books every single Wednesday. I'm actually lucky enough to be living in an age where I get to buy the comic books that I read when I was a child, once again, related to Spider-Man, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and Transformers. I was not into horror comic books until I was much older, but those three, different franchises have comic books that come out every month, and I couldn't be happier. So, like Ryan in this episode, I go to my comic book store every single week and buy them. I don't resell them at the store that he works at or happens to own, which is kind of funny. But I really, really love this episode because of all the homages to comic books and the different references to comic books. Our bad guy in the episode, who isn't so much the bad guy as much as the other bad. We have two bad guys in this episode. But this kid steals comic books, and then the store owner behind him, he's got some great comics on the wall. I wanted to point out, I saw Godzilla, Transformers, X-Men, New Mutant, The Hulk, Star Wars, and The Dark Knight Returns.
No, it was a great store. Definitely a great store. I think if this store were actually in my neighborhood, I would go see the shopkeeper Charlie and talk comic shop as well.
Correct. The episode is a great homage to what happened to several comic book people like Ray, Jay Starr. Jay Starr, who is the creator of Ferris? Was that the name?
Ferris.
Okay.
I want to just, when we're talking about this name here, I think this is a very hilarious joke, is that Ferris is the name of the character that whoever's holding the comic book kind of gets transformed into.
Yes.
Ferris is actually a type of metal. Like, it's a difference between ferrous or non-ferrous metals. Ferris contains mostly iron. So what you have is Iron Man.
Oh my God! I just suddenly realized that.
Yes,
that's awful.
Yes.
You know,
it's
one
terrible,
thing.
But it's so good.
Okay, going on to Jay Starr, who does show up very quickly. He's very much the Jack Kirby of this episode, or the Jerry Siegel or Joe Shuster. Now, Mr. Zeneca didn't have a chance to watch it, but if you do have cable, and it'll probably be on DVD at some point or online. Look up the episode of the current AMC Superhero Confidential, The Trials of Superman, which is how Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, the creators of Superman, sold Superman DC Comics for $130 with the promises of careers at DC Comics. And when they found out how much money Superman was making DC Comics, they tried to sue for control of their character back and lost and were humiliated over it.
Oh, man.
And
they
were
it's
never
sad stories.
Yeah, they went back to work for DC Comics like a year or so later, but it just wasn't the same. They were constantly pitching ideas for different characters and things to do with Superman, but they were doing basically scuttle work. And then one of the two really had it when in 1975 it was announced that Warner Brothers was beginning production on a big-budget Superman movie. And one of them was living in squalor in his cousin's basement on a cot, nearly going blind. And the other one was working in the mailroom.
This is what happened to
the creators of Superman. You know, and the same thing, by the way, happened to Bill Finger. Bill Finger, if you watch anything with Batman in it today, in the last few years, especially Justice League, there is two names that now pop up with Batman, created by Bob Kane with Bill Finger. And then if you watch the 1989 Batman or the 1960s television series, it will only say Batman created by Bob Kane.
You know, it's kind of a recurring story where, you know, even in music, there is an artist, a creator creates something, and then someone, some conglomerate, some corporation, some sleazy person sees the power of that, tries to buy it, and successfully buys it for such low pittance amount of money, and then makes it huge and big, and no matter how hard the creators try, they cannot get a slice of that. Siegel, after long, you know, protracted lawsuits after lawsuits, Siegel and Schumer were actually...
Schuster.
Were actually able to get a pension for the rest of their lives of about $20,000 a year, which increased to $30,000 plus health benefits, which that's less than the salary that a secretary makes.
Yeah.
So, you know, at Schuster's end of his life, he was actually about $20,000 in debt. And DC Comics agreed to pay off the debt. But basically, like, he had nothing.
Yeah. Years later, we finally woke up, and as much shit as people give people like Todd McFarlane about, you know, things that, you know... I don't remember exactly who started doing it. I think it was Denny O'Neill, the editor and writer of the Batman books. He really pushed forward to help Jerry Jerry Siegel and Joe Schuster. And another person, excuse me, Jesus, another person that really helped them, which you, again, watch Trials of Superman, and you'll see this, was the director of the Superman movie. Richard Donner was the person who was about to put Jerry Siegel and Joe Schuster's name in the credits for Superman when DC said, why? And he's like, because they're the creators of Superman. And he's like, I'm not releasing this movie if you... And that's when he started finding out the truth of what was happening. He didn't know. You know, he was a director hired to make Superman. And yes, he knew who Superman was. He had a passion for the character, so he wasn't just some director. He pushed forward to make sure Superman was directed by an American director because of Mom's Apple Pie and Superman's this American iconic figure. And the people who were going to have direct Superman were... You know, it was going to be some French director and something. It was really wrong at the times. Nowadays, that stuff doesn't really matter. But we never had a movie like Superman. And we're going on a tangent about this, but it's heavily related to the episode. Long story short, what happened to J-Star is very much a mirror to what happened to a lot of people, again, like Jack Kirby, who created the X-Men, the Fantastic Four, the Incredible Hulk, Captain America, the Avengers, Thor. I mean, the list goes on and on and on of the characters that he created. Within these other titles, as well as Galactus, the Black Panther was created by Jack Kirby, you know, who's getting his own big budget movie in theaters next year, starring, you know, I almost said John Boyega, but that's Finn from Star Wars. But anyway, the Black Panther is getting his own movie. I mean, that's such an iconic person connected to Jack Kirby. Thor Ragnarok, which was out in theaters last month, another huge example, especially if you saw that movie. Holy crap, the art design in that movie was mirroring Jack Kirby.
Oh, it was excellent.
But before we get right back to the episode, I wanted to just say Ray Waltzon plays J-Star, and this guy has been in so many things, but three of the biggest roles he's probably known for is playing Uncle Martin, a.k.a. the Martian from Mars in My Favorite Martian. He was the high school teacher in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, the movie.
In The Stand.
Yes,
right?
He was Glenn Bateman, one of the main characters of The Stand.
Yeah.
No,
Great actors. Both of these episodes, great actors.
Yes, 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 yes. Oh, and by the way, he also played the same character in the TV series? I didn't know there was a TV series about Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Okay, back to the episode. So Ryan goes and visits Jay, and then Jay realizes that the comic book has the ability to bring his creation to life. And you don't just bring it to life, you become the character.
And the comic actually gets absorbed into you, so you're not really holding the comic book anymore. So while you're actually Ferris, it is kind of just in you somehow.
By the way, if you want to see a fantastic picture that you would really enjoy, Mr. Zeneca, of Mr. Waltzen with the lovely and talented Karen Lore in a movie called Paramedics, where they are both in their underwear, and Karen Lore is beautiful.
Do tell.
And she has his necktie wrapped around his neck like a noose.
Uh-huh. Right up my alley.
Yes, yes. Definitely look her up. She is very, very pretty.
Okay, so it seems that Ferris is unstoppable in almost every way. He's got absolutely nothing that has been released in the comics to proclaim that he has a weakness. So he is invulnerable. He is bulletproof, you know. Like, you can laundry list the qualities of Ferris, this character, but there's one thing which was on an unreleased comic that Jay Starr produced that he says is in his basement, that is the one thing that is can kill Ferris. And guess what that is? It is his comic book award, you know, which looks like a lightning bolt on a pedestal.
Yeah, like a stabby device thing.
Yeah, so Jay Starr kind of stabs Ferris, you know, being this kid, you know, stabs this kid, kills Ferris, takes the comic book, and dashes off. Which is pretty impressive for an old guy.
Yeah, that was the weird thing about how they do away with them, was the award. And it's connected to the unproduced comic book that nobody has ever seen before.
But it's also very poetic justice, too. Because he thought that the winning the comic book award was going to be his ticket to fame, and instead he was screwed out of that fame by the corporation.
Also,
Ferris
was created back in the 1940s, according to this episode. I cannot imagine a character like this being as popular like Superman or Batman or Spider-Man today or in 1987. Like, he's a villain character. He's a violent villain character. And it relates, I think, in a way to a character called Mr. Miracle Man. I'm not going to get into the long history of Mr. Miracle Man because, good God, that is a 2-hour or more discussion. But he was a kind of anti-hero, Punisher-like villain-hero character created in the 40s or 50s, I believe, that went through like just a roller coaster of like lawsuits and things that has resurfaced today. But he's not, like, you know, getting blockbuster movies made about him in theaters right away. Mm-hmm. But he's one of these, he is, like, the original anti-hero from the golden age of comic books, which is what Ferris is. But even still, I don't see him being as, like, prolific as the episode's making him out to be.
You know, you have to have, you know, a strong character, and, you know, Lex Luthor is that old. You know, he's a villain. He's just not invulnerable like Ferris. You know, Lex Luthor, you can actually sympathize with him in some sort of way because he believes that Superman must be stopped because he is unstoppable. You know, if you twist your imagination, you can kind of, you know, do that mental gymnastic. But Ferris, you know, he is a bad guy in this episode. They show him being kind of invincible in the comic books, but you don't really see his redeeming qualities in the comic books. And that's what kind of we're missing out of this character.
Yeah. I guess, I mean, related to Lex Luthor in a way is true. Considering also today, as of recently, up until a certain storyline I'm not going to go into, but Lex Luthor had actually evolved into a kind of hero character, self-proclaimed hero character of Metropolis in the comic books, as of right now, the Superman stories. He declared himself to be Superman after an epiphany and a bunch of other stuff that happened, including donning an armor battle suit with Superman's shield on it as well.
Yeah, some weird stuff happens in the comics.
Yeah, so Superman has the Lex Luthor became this like famous like character. I thought it was funny that the guy who stole Ference away from the J-Star is Carmine DiMartino.
Mario.
Yeah, and the name reminds me a lot of Carmine Infantino, who was DC Comics editor in the Silver Age, as well as writer, and I think he was creator of the Silver Age Flash, a.k.a. Barry Allen, who's currently running around.
I think that was actually done on purpose.
Yeah, but I don't remember Carmine Infantino ever being a jackass. I only ever heard really great things about him, so I wonder if they just pulled that name out because the writers are not really comic book readers.
Maybe, or it was just kind of an homage.
Yeah. I do love the fact that they shoot this guy in the body in the full suit of armor, this Iron Man. And when you said that his name means, like, Iron Man, I think this our imaginary villain character is more in tune with the Ozzy Osbourne, I'm sorry, Black Sabbath song than Tony Stark. Think about it.
Perhaps,
yeah. Think
perhaps.
About the lyrics.
Works.
Yeah.
It plays.
I mean, the Black Sabbath song is definitely more of like a, kind of like thinking of Iron Man as more like a villain. But yes, of course, when you hear Iron Man, you could obviously today think more of like Tony Stark.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he's still kind of an asshole, but you know, that's the way the character was designed.
By the way, so if Jay Starr lost control of this character, how the hell is he living in that mansion? Because Jerry Siegel and Jack Kirby were not living in no Hollywood luscious mansion.
Well, it was mentioned that Carmine's dad had given him a very lucrative deal for the character. So it was a lot of money even back then, he said. So he might have like purchased the house outright, purchased the land, so then what he's living on is a modest amount. You know, he doesn't have a lot of extremely high bills. The nurse's salary would be the highest, I would think. And the nurse ends up actually betraying J-Star at the end of the episode.
Yeah,
she just sells out his stuff from the basement without telling him.
Now, was that his wife or his nursemaid? Because she...
Nurse.
Okay, because she makes a comment about that.
Yeah, no, that was the nurse. I think, Elise actually mentions that in her book.
Okay.
So, the nurse actually sold the unpublished comics to a dealer, Ted Haley, and Mickey and Ryan go to the auction in which these books are going to be sold, sneak out that 1980s Rolodex card of his information, and find him dead. So, all of the works are gone, he is dead, and, you know, that's, I think, the fifth death of this show. And then...
In this episode?
Yeah, that was death number 5. There's
okay, in the episode.
Six deaths in this show.
In the episode?
In this episode.
Okay.
Yeah.
Alright, I had lost count for a second there.
Yeah,
and so, I was just like, oh, maybe she'll keep count because I completely lost count at the end.
No, I totally kept count. So 6 deaths in this episode. The dealer, Ted Haley, was number 5, and J-Star at the very end. Ryan has to kill his idol, his artist favorite, J-Star, at the very end when he turns into Ferris, and he kills him with the statuette, and that makes death number 6.
Now, what, by the way, does Ryan use to look for the information needed on the secretary's desk?
On the secretary's desk?
No, sorry, not on the... Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, it was the secretary's desk. At the auction house.
What, the clipboard or the Rolodex?
The Rolodex, the Rolodex.
Rolodex, yeah.
Yes. When was the last time you saw a Rolodex in the 21st century? Not since the smartphone was invented, right?
Yeah, no, that's a clear classic 80s Rolodex.
Yeah, I guess you could say since the cell phone was invented that could store phones that you could scroll through, right? Because, I mean, the whole purpose of a Rolodex was to keep your phone numbers handy, but once the cell phone was developed with a screen, you could just scroll through the numbers that you need to find to call mom or dad.
Yeah, but, you know, there's still those numbers that you'll never forget kind of roaming in your head.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you call a certain number all the time, sure.
Yeah. So, there's one moment at the very end of the episode, Mickey is kind of now getting into reading Tales of the Undead comic.
Oh, yeah.
When in the beginning of the episode, she's like, I don't get it. So there's one moment, like, she tosses her hair back and suggests, come upstairs to see my etchings, when he mentions, you know, showing her his illustrations.
Correct.
You know, and he says it in this very kind of blank matter of fact, oh, would you like to see my drawings, you know, and she kind of turns it along a little bit on that flirtatious side. I was like, Mickey, what are you doing? You just broke up with your fiance, so, and they're cousins.
But only by marriage, and if this was a porno, that would be totally fine.
It's true, you know, but that's that, you know, a little tiny bit of sexual tension going on.
You know, yeah.
It
is funny that there is this underlining weird sexual incest comments made. And again, as I previously mentioned, we had Lloyd being played by an actor who's on Riverdale. Now, if anyone watching Riverdale, and I'm going to expose this, I don't care because we're not covering Riverdale. On Riverdale, two of the characters are revealed who banged each other and got pregnant are revealed to be distant cousins from a Hadfield and McCoy rivalry that began 100 years ago in Riverdale. It was two brothers, and they feuded and hated each other, and they divided the family up, and one changed his name and became this family, and the other one kept the name and became that family, and they were fighting each other. And the feud continued to this very day with Betty's, you know, as in Betty and Veronica, Betty's older sister was revealed to be cousins or relatives to the Blossom family, and the brother Jason Blossom, who died, was revealed to be the father of the Betty's older sister, the baby inside her, and that's the incestuous plot that, you know, that everyone was talking about on Riverdale. Just like they brought in incest into Archie.
Ah, gross.
Yeah.
You know, I was talking with my fiance, and he was like, how can you be cousins by marriage? And I had to actually diagram it out. Okay, well, there's Uncle Louis, who might have had two sisters, we'll just say that, and if one of the sisters had a daughter, and that was Mickey, and then one of the sisters married a guy that had a son, that would be Ryan, so they're cousins by marriage. And he goes, oh, well, I guess that makes sense. You know, so at some point, you know, one of them is a stepchild at some point in this family.
Now, you know this is a Friday the 13th TV series, as Roby falls down for no apparent reason. Just going to point that out. How many women fall down in a Friday the 13th movie for no apparent reason by tripping over their own 2 feet? I'm sorry, but I have been running in the woods or running across the field or seen enough women run before that they don't just fall down randomly. And
it's
Roby doesn't.
It's a horror trope. You gotta go with it.
And so, again, you know that it's a Friday the 13th TV series because the female falls down. And she's not a virgin either, apparently. We noticed that by the last episode. So so she has to die.
I mean, I would hope not. You know, she's a grown-ass woman.
No, so, and she's not a teenager either, but, no. She has
expiration date on that.
she has checked off two things on her list of reasons why she has to die. Spoiler alert, Roby lives through the entire show.
I don't think that's a spoiler. That's a main feature of the show.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't like Silk Stockings where they kill off our two main characters. Ooh, you know what? We should do Silk Stockings one day. You ever watch that show?
I did.
That show's too long for us to do. That went for like 6 seasons. We would never get off of it. But that was a sexy show in the 90s.
Oh, that was like on Skinamax, I think, wasn't it?
No, USA Network. At 10 o'clock at night. 10 o'clock at night on Sundays.
USA. Okay.
Yeah, and I've actually had the female star of that show on my show.
Sexy.
Yes. In fact, and not only did I have her on my show, I actually got to ride with her in a limo one time.
Ooh.
Yes. Damn, one of my biggest... Mitzi Capture is her name, and yes, she is as beautiful in real life as she was on that show in the 80s.
You know, I am glad to hear that.
Oh, by the way, I got to correct myself. That show ran for 8 freaking seasons, 176 episodes. We would never be done with it.
Yeah, no. We're doing season 1, and then we're doing a short animation. I think we're doing Spawn, and then we're doing season 2.
Yeah.
So we're going to break it up a little bit. But yeah. If we had to do that for 8 seasons, oh my God.
Yeah, we'll be doing Spawn for like probably 6 episodes to divide up the because it's 6 episode seasons. So 3 episodes, 3 animated episodes per podcast.
We don't want to spend forever, just like a whole year doing
Friday the 13th.
Series. We're going to break it up a little bit, make it a little interesting here.
Yes, definitely. Well, that's pretty much all I have for this episode.
Yeah.
I mean, they were both really good episodes. I just didn't have as many notes as I thought I was going to.
Well, we need to talk about the MacGuffins of both, so...
Oh, yeah. You know. I don't own a Mulcher, but I own 20... Okay, I'm not going to joke about this. I own 22 long white boxes of comic books.
You geek.
Yes, but I don't own a cursed comic book that has tried to kill me. However, the oldest comic book I own is a copy of Amazing Spider-Man number 37, volume 1 from the 1960s. It is the first appearance of Norman Osborn. Now, I did not say the first appearance of the Green Goblin. The Green Goblin's first appearance is Amazing Spider-Man number 14. We would get the first appearance of Norman Osborn in issue 37, and then 2 issues later, the issue that actually broke up Steve Ditko and Stan Lee was where we find out the truth that Norman Osborn has been the Green Goblin the whole time. But that's a huge part of, like, it's considered like the Goblin origin trilogy. You have his first appearance, you have the first appearance of his secret identity, and then you have the origin where he reveals his identity to Peter.
Well, I also do not own a Mulcher because I live in Philadelphia, so I don't have a backyard.
Not a lot of neighborhoods in Philadelphia.
My backyard is about the size of 10 foot by 12 foot, and I've got 2 4x4 garden boxes in it. So that's the extent of the actual plant life that's in my backyard. So there's no need to mulch anything. But I do have about 3 short boxes of comics, and most of them are signed because I am an autograph hunter, and I don't know what my most valuable signature is, but I do have, which I just got at Dragon Con this past summer, Stan Lee! So, I have his autograph.
Oh my God.
Stan the Man, before he dies, I got his autograph, fully authenticated and all that. But there is one comic that is an X-Men, and I would say that the character name and my actual name are completely the same, and the character looks exactly like me, and when I confronted the creator of that character, he was a little astounded, looking at me and then looking at my badge, and he says, "You're her." And so I'm like, "Yeah," and so it is an X-Men character, and it does bear my name and my likeness, and I have it fully autographed every appearance of her.
And what character is this again?
Okay, this is giving away my real name, but...
okay, gotcha, all right. yeah, okay, then never
it's
mind.
It's a villain.
It's a villain, okay.
It's a villain.
I'm not... You know, I've read plenty of X-Men comics. In fact, I have the original run of Uncanny X-Men on a CD-ROM, but... Yeah, I'm trying to think what care villain you have as your name. When you said it was based on you, I was thinking of some dominatrix character, but no.
I mean, she is kind of a bitch, but no, she is the was in the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants.
Okay.
Brotherhood of Evil with Magneto.
With Magneto, so okay.
Yes.
Not Magneto. The other versions of the Brotherhood of Mutants. Okay.
Correct.
Magneto. I also hunt down autographs for comic books themselves. I've never got Stan Lee's because Stan Lee is ridiculously expensive. It's like $75.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just no, can't do it, not going to do it. I would have to say the comic book I own that has the most expensive signature on it, I guess if you can call it that, is... maybe a comic book signed by Gene Cullen because he's dead. He created, he was the artist on Tomb of Dracula and created Blade the Vampire Hunter. I have his signature on a couple items. Excuse me. But I also have, like, the first appearance of the Hobgoblin signed by John Romita Jr., who is still alive. Marv Wolfman has signed the first appearance of Deathstroke the Terminator, who's the Teen Titans villain.
Nice.
By the way, I don't know if you saw online, did you see the first image of Robin has appeared for the upcoming Teen Titans TV series?
I did not see that.
Yes, and he looks awesome. Now, the question everyone has, though, is which Robin is this? Because they've already said that the Titans will be formed by Nightwing, which is Dick Grayson's older adult identity. But the image that we've been shown is of Robin, and it's of the Tim Drake-style costume. So I'm wondering, is this the next Robin in the line of Robins that Batman goes through? Tim Drake, probably the most popular Robin of all time, because he's the one from the 90s that everyone really got hooked on. Or are we seeing Dick Grayson in a flashback when he's younger? So,
you know, I don't know. It's hard to keep up with the amount of Robins because they kind of drop like flies at times.
Yeah, but definitely check out the image of the new Robin, because this is like the first live action Robin we've had since Batman and Robin, not counting Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character from The Dark Knight Rises. It's not the same thing.
Yeah.
At the end of the movie, she says to him, "Why don't you use your real name, Robin?" And I'm like, "Oh, come on." Anyway, moving on.
That's it.
Yeah, you can find us on the Dead TV Podcast on Facebook. You can find Mr. Zeneca and I on our individual Twitters at ChrisDSAV and
at Elegantly Kinky.
And don't forget, if you are a business like Wicked Chronic in Natick, Massachusetts, want to sponsor the show, please give us an email at thatradiohorror@gmail.com, as well as we have a Patreon page. If you'd like to help us support us on Patreon, please do.
It really helps support
the Don't talk. Hold on. I gotta edit that part out. Yes, please. Whoa, you got sirens
behind
you.
Hold on.
And don't forget, you can sponsor us on Patreon as well. If you would wish to, go to our Patreon page at Radio of Horror. Thank you, Mr. Zeneca, for joining me for the Dead TV Podcast once again.
It's always my pleasure.
And we will see you back here again when we record. We'll be recording with Elise Wax.
Yes, author of Curious Goods, Behind the Scenes of Friday the 13th, series.
And, by the way, since we're kicking off the holiday season now, don't forget you can pick up Friday the 13th, the box set, as well as Elise's book on Amazon, and you can also pick up the Friday the 13th box set on Amazon or at Best Buy. It's like usually $20 to $30 for the entire series.
It's definitely worth it to take that trip back in time.
Yes, definitely. If you're a big horror fan, it is absolutely worth checking out.